University of Cambridge Graduate Diploma in Economics. Dr. Mark Hayes on Monetary Macroeconomics. Lecture 2, Aggregate Demand, Consumption and the Keynesian Cross. In the first lecture, I introduced you to the ADAS model, which represents the new consensus in macroeconomics. And this new consensus seeks to reconcile the insights of classical and Keynesian macroeconomics. The reconciliation is achieved by confining the Keynesian view to the short run, in which prices are held to be fixed or sticky, and arguing that in the long run, with price flexibility, the level of output and employment will be determined by the real forces described in the classical intertemporal macroeconomic model. Thus, the consensus holds that while the economy is subject to a variety of shocks and squalls, it has a tendency to right itself like a lifeboat rather than sink. Laissez-faire and market forces will in the long run produce full employment, that is, the optimal allocation of resources given technology and preferences. Now, our ultimate purpose in this course of lectures is to understand the business cycle and what, if anything, policymakers should do about it. In order to do that, we need to take apart the ADAS model and find out what makes it tick. Over the next four lectures, I shall examine in detail the thinking behind the downward sloping AD curve. And this graphic provides you with a map through the model and the next five lectures. I'll begin by explaining two traditional Keynesian models. The Keynesian cross, devised by the Harvard economist Alvin Hansen, and the ISLM model, created by John Hicks, a mainly Oxford economist, who lectured in Cambridge in the 1930s at the same time as Keynes was writing the general theory. The ISLM model was extended to take account of floating exchange rates by Robert Mundell and Marcus Fleming in 1962 to give us what is called the IS star LM star model. And the AD curve incorporates all three of these models. Go back a bit then. From the particular perspective of the new consensus, in which the price level P is the key factor linking demand and long-run supply. And in lecture 6, we'll look at approaches to aggregate supply, other than the polar opposites of the horizontal short-run curve and the vertical long-run curve, including the Phillips curve. In the final lectures, let me just sort of give you the map there. So that's aggregate supply there. And here is the Phillips curve. That's right. In the final lectures, number 7 and 8, we'll pull this all together to consider whether policymakers can or should do anything about the business cycle, both using this model and touching on some alternative approaches. Now, in mathematical terms, there are several endogenous or dependent variables we are interested in. That is, variables that the model is intended to explain, and these are written in each box. The main ones are output, Y, and the price level, P, which you've already heard about yesterday. But also, behind the scenes of the ADAS diagram, as it were, there are at least another five endogenous variables. These are the nominal interest rate, I, and the nominal exchange rate, E, as well as the individual components of Y, consumption, C, investment, I, and net exports, NX, that is, exports less imports. Employment is tied to Y by the production function, So it's not directly visible. Only P and Y appear in the labour market AS box. So you probably already feel that the simple ADAS diagram hides a mass of complexity, and you'd be right. The diagram represents a system of up to 7 simultaneous relationships or equations. So no wonder we need a model. Macroeconomics is complicated because everything connects. Too much is happening at once. However, we can get a window on the system without needing to use advanced mathematics, though some of you probably can do the advanced mathematics, or we're doing it without it. In fact, we have several windows onto the system. Each submodel is illustrated by a diagram, which you can think of, but only if you like that kind of image, as a two-dimensional section through the intersection of a set of hyperplanes in 7 dimensions. So each cross-section shows the interaction between only 2 of the endogenous variables. It's like a window onto a box, onto a system, which is actually, the window is along one pair of dimensions, orthogonal to all the others. Only if you find that sort of image helpful. There are also several exogenous or independent variables, that is, variables which are inputs to the model but not themselves explained by it. And changes in the exogenous variables are represented by shifts in the curves and the corresponding equilibrium solution, of course. And the exogenous variables in this model include government spending and taxation, G and T, the money supply, M, the money wage, W, and the foreign interest rate, I star. And I'll just bring that back into the picture. When we extend it to the foreign sector, there you can see all 7 variables in the bottom right-hand corner. We're particularly interested in what happens if policymakers change G or T, which is called fiscal policy, or change M, which is shorthand in this model for monetary policy. Another crucial policy decision is whether to fix the exchange rate or allow it to float. So we have a lot to get through, and let's begin by considering this slide. The short-run equilibrium in the ADAS shifts by the same amount as the AD curve. Okay, so the equilibrium, the intersection, shifts by the same amount as the curve. Okay? And at fixed prices, this means a change in demand translates directly into a change in real output. And this is the simplified version of Keynesian economics that Hansen and Paul Samuelson put forward, avoiding Keynes's own much more complex exposition, which assumes flexible prices, contrary to popular belief. However, the assumption of fixed prices makes it easier to consider aggregate demand in isolation from aggregate supply, so we can break down the problem a bit. And since aggregate demand is quite complicated enough on its own, this is a definite aid to learning. So what we'll do today, let's go back a bit, is take the first step in explaining the AD curve using the so-called Keynesian cross, to which is related various forms of the multiplier. Although the multiplier is the best known idea in the general theory, Keynes gave the credit to Richard Kahn, a rather gentle retiring man who spent almost his entire life here in King's College, helping other people, including Keynes, to perfect their work, and also Nicholas Kaldor and Joan Robinson, to perfect their work rather than achieving great fame for himself. And you can listen, actually, to a rare 1987 recording of a talk by the elderly Kahn, obviously, on the post-Keynesian website on the Scourge of Monetarism was the title of his talk. Just jump forward again. There we go. Now, the first thing to grasp is what is Y. Income Y is the value of output. And that's not immediately obvious. After all, most of us think of income as a sum of money. And that's certainly true for an individual. And furthermore, income is intrinsically monetary outside a one commodity corn model, since the value of output depends on a set of prices. Nevertheless, for the economy as a whole, income has to equal the value of output, and the circular flow diagram illustrates the point. And here you can see how households earn a flow of income by supplying labour to firms, while at the same time households spend money on the output of the firms. And there are no numbers on these flows, but you can see the basic idea that income is created by the value of output. And this diagram makes the same point with a bit more detail. Each yellow box, represents a type of economic actor. Each blue box represents a type of market. And the green arrows show the flows of income and expenditure. Firms receive revenue from selling goods and pay out to factors of production, that is, labour, land and capital. Households own the factors of production and receive income, which they either spend on consumption, pay in taxes, or save. The government receives taxes and spends. Any surplus of tax overspend is public saving. And sales of investment goods by firms equal the value of private and public saving. Now, the equality of investment and saving is in the first instance an accounting identity, what we call the national income identity, and it does not depend on financial markets channeling saving into investment, as this diagram suggests. For the economy as a whole, income not consumed, that is, saved, must be invested. Saving is simply the accounting record of investment. This doesn't alter the fact that savers and investors are different people, nor that some saving or investment may be involuntary. But the identity must hold in aggregate. The classical and the Keynesian models offer different explanations as to how the consumption and investment plans behind this identity are reconciled. There's the identity, but there's then the question of the equilibrium. The two things need to be distinguished. Now, the classical model, as set out in Intertemporal Macro, makes sense as a corn model, in which one commodity, corn, can be either eaten, stored, planted, or lent to someone else. The expected output of corn for the coming year, which is the expected income, okay, is determined when the workers and the farmers agree, after the previous harvest, if you like, a wage in terms of corn for which they will work over the next year to produce the next harvest. And provided that the workers agree to accept a wage at the next harvest equal to what the farmers expect to be their marginal product of corn, they can all be employed. The harvest takes place and all the corn is placed in granaries by the farmers. The custodians of the granaries issue receipts for the deposited corn. And the farmers transfer some of these receipts to the workers, and the landlords who can redeem them for corn at any time. So you can think of these receipts as the equivalent of money, and the granary as both bank and retail store. Some of the corn is needed for planting, otherwise there won't be a harvest next year. And in a market economy, it is the farmers who decide how much corn to plant and how many workers to employ. We've already discussed how the market determines the wage, which is a promise to hand over to the workers receipts for the agreed amount of corn at the next harvest. In exactly the same fashion, the market clearing interest rate is the expected marginal product of capital of seed corn in this model when all the available seed corn is planted. Once the harvest has been gathered in, imagine everyone sits down to plan and haggle. People plan to use at least some of their granary receipts over the next year to draw out corn to eat and to save the rest. And some of their saving they keep in the form of receipts, representing a bit extra in the granary to provide for emergencies. So this leaves a certain amount of corn in the granary that they are sure they will not need during the year, and which they're willing to plant or to lend to others who will plant it. So the savers offer loans of granary receipts, yeah? And the farmers bid for them so that they can draw out the corn and employ the workers to plant it. So, it's a parable, okay? The key point about it is that the amount of corn in the granary, aggregate income, is fixed by the harvest and subject to the perils of agriculture by the earlier employment decision. Any income that's not earmarked for consumption, i.e. saving, is sitting in the granary and is available for lending to the highest bidder. Saving has already materialized and is then deployed for investment, with the real interest rate clearing the market. In a monetary economy, unlike this agricultural model, the level of income is not determined by the price of labour and its physical productivity alone. It also depends on how much firms expect to sell, and that depends on how much people are expected to consume and invest. But that depends on how much income people earn. So it sounds like a circular argument. But as we shall see, it does converge. It's simultaneous rather than circular, which is an important difference. And this is where the Keynesian cross comes in. The Keynesian cross is a simple model where we hold net exports as one of the exogenous variables and which we hold investment as one of the exogenous variables. So the only things that can move in this model are income and consumption. And so we write down these symbols. So we have an equation for expected spending, E equals C plus I plus G, where C represents private consumption, G represents government consumption, and I is investment. Of course, the income Y is also equal to C plus I plus G is a matter of accounting, and in equilibrium, Y equals E. So there's two things here. One's the accounting identity, the other's the equilibrium. We can then introduce a consumption function, which is relating private consumption to disposable income, that is, income after tax. C1 is the coefficient. This means that only private consumption varies with income. So we now have two equations in two unknowns, Y and C, and we can show the solution using a diagram, Hansen's famous Keynesian cross. These are the exogenous variables. So you've got the expenditure, expected expenditure equation, E, and the equilibrium condition that Y must equal E. So we draw the equilibrium condition as a simple 45 degree line representing the need for expected expenditure to equal the value of output. And the second line represents the equation, the expenditure equation. We can bring these together and the intersection gives us the solution to this simple model, the equilibrium income. Now the existence and the stability of the equilibrium depends on the slope of the expected expenditure line being less than unity. I'll let you work that one out. But since the only spending variable here is private consumption, this means that when income increases, consumption also increases, but less than income. So Keynes called the ratio of the extra consumption to the extra income the marginal propensity to consume, or MPC, as it's abbreviated. Now, classical economists have been rather rude about this consumption function. It's claimed to be ad hoc and without behavioural micro-foundations. There have been various theories put forward since Keynes to explain aggregate consumption in terms of intertemporal macro, including Friedman's permanent income hypothesis and Hall's random walk hypothesis. If you want the detail, read chapter 17 of Mankiw's text, the more detailed one. However, Keynes's consumption function is both simpler and more subtle. It does not represent simply personal consumption, as is assumed here, but aggregate consumption. The consumption function is the relationship between aggregate consumption and income, not only of individuals, but of institutions, such as corporations, banks, and in the general theory, government itself. Increases in income often accrue as profits of corporations, which are not immediately paid out as dividends. Joan Robinson and the Cambridge post-Keynesians, as they're called, preferred to model consumption in terms of economic classes, with workers spending what they get and capitalists getting what they spend, investment creating saving in the form of profits. Now, the other point about the consumption function is that this diagram makes no assumption about unemployment or the level of employment, while intertemporal macro necessarily assumes full employment, which clearly influences consumption behaviour. So we're talking about actually two different animals here, and although certainly Keynes's consumption function is an abstraction, unlike others, it does not assume away the central question whether competition alone, price competition, can lead the economy to full employment. Be that as it may, the Keynesian cross shows how the level of output and employment in a monetary economy is determined in the goods market by the supply and demand for goods and services. And this contrasts with a classical model where output and employment are determined in the labour market by the supply and demand for labour. So income can now be at a level which does not correspond to full employment of the available labour. You'll note there's a certain ratio implicit of consumption to investment in this model. In the simplest version, without government, the ratio would correspond to the marginal propensity to consume. In other words, the average propensity to consume would be equal to the marginal propensity to consume. So if the marginal propensity to consume was 0.8, for example, consumption would be four times investment. And the multiple is important when we come to consider how equilibrium income changes when we change one of the exogenous variables.
Now, this could be investment, which is exogenous to this model, government consumption or net exports. All are forms of spending which are independent of domestic income. What matters here is their autonomy from income. So let's just look at what happens if you change autonomous consumption. This is an effect of an increase in G. So the expenditure line moves up G1 to G2, delta G. Okay. And it cuts the 45 degree line higher up. This corresponds to a new higher equilibrium income Y2. The difference is delta Y. The ratio, which is there, the ratio of delta Y to delta G is called the spending multiplier. It tells by how much income will increase for a given increase in autonomous spending. In mathematical terms, this is an exercise in comparative statics. We're asking ourselves how the equilibrium solution for the endogenous variables changes when we change one of the exogenous variables. This means we can use the calculus to derive the precise value of the multiplier. We start with the equation for the equilibrium solution, which I emphasize again is not to be confused with the accounting identity. We then differentiate it. Delta I is zero because we're holding investment exogenous. And after we rearrange it, we make the function for delta C explicit, and we rearrange. Basically, we get an equation for the multiplier as 1 over as the inverse of the marginal propensity to save, if you like to look at it that way. Now, earlier I suggested that in the simplest model, with investment but no other autonomous spending, the ratio of consumption to investment and total income would correspond to the marginal propensity to consume. When there's more than one form of autonomous spending, the simple relationship doesn't hold for the total, but it does hold for the increase. So if we have a marginal propensity to consume of 0.8, the multiplier has a value of 5. In other words, this means that an increase in the government spending or any autonomous spending can increase income by as much as 5 times. That's a bit high, to be honest, but we've left a lot out of this model. Generally, you'd expect it to be something around between 1 and 2 for various reasons we've not yet come to, but you get the idea. And just to be clear how this can be, it's not some kind of free lunch. The point is that the consumption that is expected from an increase in income has to be reconciled with the total expected spending, including the induced consumption that gives rise to the increase in income. So it's this circular thing. So we start with an increase representing an equal increase in Y, but then Y increases C, which means Y goes up, which means C goes up, which means Y goes up. So it goes round and round. But the point is it's a convergent series, and the calculus just shows that by a different way. The increase in income has to be enough so that people are willing to increase their saving out of their increased incomes to equal the increase in the autonomous spending. Where the spending is investment, we can say that investment creates saving. This is the opposite from the classical model, in which saving can be said to create investment. In a famous phrase, James Mead of the Mead Room stated that Keynes changed our view of the world from one in which a saving dog wags an investment tail to one in which an investment dog wags a saving tail. And the shape of the consumption function tells us how much income has to increase to achieve this. The multiplier is a function of the marginal propensity to consume. Multiplier is best understood as an exercise in comparative statics, but naturally people want to know how the economy moves from one equilibrium position to another. This turns out to be one of the most complicated questions in macroeconomics, and one on which I've spent a lot of my time in research. If you want to follow that up, have a look at some of my recent publications on the faculty website on the state of short-term expectation and effective demand. The conventional story of how you move from one equilibrium to another is represented by this slide. If income's above the equilibrium to the right, planned expenditure is less than output, so firms accumulate inventories. This leads them to reduce output and move towards equilibrium. The opposite occurs if income starts below equilibrium. Nice and clear. But the subtle problem is that in this diagram, expenditure is planned rather than expected. The issue is whether employment is determined by the plans of spenders or the expectations of employers. And it's employers who actually control production and output. So this diagram is not, I think, the best way to explain the expectations of employers. And the problem with a conventional story is that it depends on the assumption of fixed prices. Yes, we've accepted that, meaning that changes in demand translate directly into changes in output. And that does lead to the view of the Keynesian system as hydraulic economics, in which there is no room for price competition, no so-called micro-foundations. And the ultimate expression of this is the Phillips machine, a water-driven analog computer invented by an engineer-turned economist at the LSE in 1949. And we've actually got one of these in the Mead Room, in the faculty. And Alan McRoby of the engineering faculty got it working again in 2003 to celebrate the centenary of the economics tripos. And with a bit of luck, I'll show you how it works.
Can we see the real thing?
So the first experiment we're going to do is the Keynesian multiplier, which is where the economists can help me to explain how it works. It's the magic of economics. What I'm proposing to do is make a billion a year increase in investment. So we go from 1 to 1, we'll go to 1 to 2, so we should go from 4 to 5. But we don't go from 4 to 5, we add 1 and we get 6. 4 plus 1 makes 6 in economics. Via the Keynesian multiplier, via this thing here, which is your propensity to consume curve. The simplest I've heard it explained is that if you make the 1 investment, the butcher pays the baker, pays the candlestick maker, and it goes round until you get more for your money. So I've got this propensity to consume curve. It's got a slope of about 2 at the moment, which means basically you spend half and save half of your net income, which is powered by this here. And I've taken all of the other graphs out, all of the other little sliders to keep it simple. So I've got taxation, there's no taxation rates. We're just going to have the billion and a billion here. And every other graph is out except for propensity to consume, and that's all shut down. So I've just settled on an equilibrium. I think we're just about there. Just above 4 on the graph. I'll just get a little steady trace and then we'll see what happens. Okay, 1, 2, 1. I'm going to push this up to 2. So according to the prediction, we should go from 4 to 6 here because the slope of the marginal propensity to consume is 2. So the multiplier theory says it should be 1 over your propensity to save. Propensity to save is 1 over a half, gives you the 2. 1 over the propensity to save, which is a half, gives you the 2. So we should get a multiplier of 2, and this should go from 4 to 6. It's already rising beautifully. You can see over here. Oops, sorry, I just knocked it there. It should go up to a nice sort of exponential growth to 2.
I mean, there can be no doubt that, you know, a simple, literally hydraulic model makes some of the more abstract reasoning easier to grasp. However, you may already be able to spot the flaw. which is quite simply that it uses water. This is essentially a corn model. If you watch the whole video, there's the diagram of the thing. You can watch the video on, it's on the Cambridge website. And you'll hear Alan explaining how loanable funds are modelled by the machine, the equivalent of the granary in our earlier analogy. So unfortunately, the moment you start thinking of money income in terms of corn or water, you're driven inexorably back to the classical model. So the model is to some extent flawed as a representation of Keynesian monetary economics, but it is quite fun, isn't it? Back to the more abstract stuff. We've now established how equilibrium income is established in a simple monetary model, and we won't dwell at this stage on how you move from one position of equilibrium to another. We can do another simple, similar exercise in comparative statics by altering another exogenous variable, the income tax, T, to produce another form of multiplier, the tax multiplier. In this model, T is effectively a poll tax, which doesn't vary with income, but obviously has to be paid out of income, therefore reducing disposable income. Another way of looking at it is an increase in the personal allowance or income tax threshold, which takes a fixed sum away from everybody. So this slide shows the effect of an increase in T. The expenditure line moves down and cuts the 45-degree line lower down. This time the shift in the line is not delta T, but delta T times the marginal propensity to consume, since what matters is the effect of the tax increase on consumption spending. And the lower expenditure line corresponds to a new lower equilibrium income, Y2. And the difference again is delta Y. The ratio of delta Y to delta T is called the tax multiplier. And it tells us by how much income will fall for a given increase in a fixed tax. And again, we can calculate the exact value of the tax multiplier using calculus. If we again assume, well, you can see the formula is slightly different, and if we assume that the marginal propensity to consume is 0.8, the tax multiplier comes out at minus 4. So the key point about the tax multiplier is that it's negative, of course. A tax increase reduces consumption, which reduces income. It's greater than 1 in absolute value because a change in taxes has a multiplier effect on income. But it is smaller than the spending multiplier because consumers save the fraction the marginal propensity to save of a tax cut, so that the initial boost in spending is smaller. The third multiplier we can usefully discuss today is something called the balanced budget multiplier. It's a bit more complicated. What it says is that income will rise by the amount of any increase in government spending, even when the spending is fully funded by taxation. And this very rough diagram comes from my draft text, Macro Restated, to which I'll send you a download link. The increase in government spending is shown by the upward shift from the blue to the yellow line, and the effect of the increased taxation is shown by the second shift down from the yellow to the red. So the implication is that the economy moves from the equilibrium point A to B. And the rest of the symbols are explained in the text. The key point is that if you can see the green sides of the triangle ABC, AC and BC are equal. And the calculus actually for once makes it perhaps easier than a diagram. We have to introduce a proportional income tax, that's the little t, as well as a lump sum tax to make this more realistic. But it doesn't matter whether it's a fixed tax or a proportional tax. If we put that equation for government expenditure into the equilibrium condition, and then do the differentiating and manipulating, you end up with this chain of stuff which you can work through afterwards, which basically the multiplier drops out with a value equal to 1. Now, the balanced budget multiplier makes a very important practical point. The government can always ensure full employment in a monetary economy by increasing public spending and taxation together to whatever level necessary. Just remember the Soviet Union. It's not about running a deficit or unsustainable public finances. There is one important economic caveat, which is that spending and taxation have to increase in real terms if the increase in income is to translate into employment. The assumption of fixed prices therefore has to hold in the long run, and we've yet to discuss that. And there's also a possibility of genuine so-called crowding out at full employment, where the public sector may divert physical resources from, quotes, better uses in the private sector rather than using unemployed resources, because we're now at full employment. So the argument then essentially becomes largely political rather than economic. If full employment were achieved, there might be a debate over the better application of resources, as we might have in, you know, the intertemporal model. However, this tends to become a debate over the level of taxation. Some argue that taxation is theft, so that any diversion of resources into the public sector, whatever the level of unemployment, is a necessary evil that should be limited to the bare minimum required to maintain law and order. The same people tend to argue that the public sector is intrinsically less efficient than the private sector in delivering services because of the absence of the profit motive. I think as economists we need to try and be objective. The safety record of the private railway network in the UK, the international misallocation of resources to financial services, in each case followed by public bailouts and partial nationalisation, these things suggest the matter is more complicated. A more moderate view is that people prefer to spend money individually rather than collectively, so that high levels of taxation lead to democratic governments losing elections, unless there is a strong political consensus in support of the services provided by public spending. And there is, for example, a clear contrast between the politics of the United States and Scandinavia. And that's a battle that's currently being fought out in this country as we speak. There are political limits, therefore, to the government's ability to step in if private expenditure is insufficient to support full employment. It's therefore important, as economists, to identify whether there is any strictly economic reason for believing that private expenditure will tend to fall short as a general rule. And the answer to that question clearly has profound implications for the political debate over the economic role of government. So let me now just recap on what we've covered in the lecture. I've explained that in this and the next few lectures, we're going to take apart the ADAS model and look at the detailed reasoning behind this deceptively simple diagram. We're discussing an equilibrium system with several endogenous variables, of which the level of income Y and the price level P, which appear in the ADAS diagram, they're only 2 of as much as 7. In mathematical terms, it's a system of simultaneous equations. The variable of particular interest to us is the level of income, since it is fluctuations in income and the related employment which define what we mean by the business cycle. However, there are several interactions or feedbacks between the endogenous variables that makes the analysis quite difficult, and that's why we need a model. In this lecture, we began our detailed look at the AD curve by using a simple model in which only consumption and income are allowed to vary, while the demand from investment and foreign trade are held constant. This model, known as the Keynesian cross, allows us to show how the level of equilibrium income is determined in the goods market, in the Keynesian monetary model, rather than in the labour market, as in the classical intertemporal model. It also allows us to understand how, while in the intertemporal model, a saving dog wags an investment tail, in the monetary model, it's an investment dog that wags a saving tail. The direction of causation between saving and investment is reversed. The Keynesian cross also allows us to understand the concept of the multiplier, the change in income that results from a change in autonomous spending. The multiplier can be understood in mathematical terms as a partial derivative in an exercise in comparative statics. We considered three versions of the multiplier: the spending, tax, and balanced budget multipliers. And I pointed out to you the difference between two equilibrium positions and the process by which we get from one to another. Sorry, let me rephrase that. I pointed out to you the difference between two separate equilibrium positions and the process by which you get from one to another. And I've cautioned you that the conventional story of quantity adjustments is only partially correct, and if followed uncritically, leads to hydraulic Keynesian economics and back to the classical model. So next time we'll finish our consideration of the domestic aggregate demand curve by allowing investment to vary as well as consumption using something called the ISLM model.